readers, welcome to the Book Reports. This week, we're taking our annual look at the Oscar-worthy books, right in time for the big event, the 86th annual presentation of the Academy Awards. A moment of truth. Yes, we're marginally interested in the awards, but most of us are majorly interested in who's wearing what. But I digress. Of course, behind every great movie is, usually, an even greater book. So hooray for Hollywood! And the authors who give us the incredible stories upon which award-winning films are based. Let's raise the curtain on our special book report salute to actors, Hollywood, and the Academy, as we turn to page one of the book report. The film Philomena is nominated for Best Picture. It was directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed The Queen and High Fidelity. The incomparable Judi Dench has received a nomination for Best Actress, and the movie is in the running for Best Adapted Screenplay. The film is based on the book by Martin Sixsmith, Philomena, A Mother, Her Son, and a 50-Year Search. It's the heartbreaking true story of an Irish woman and the secret she kept for 50 years. In 1952, Philomena Lee, a teenager in Ireland, became pregnant. She was sent to a convent to be looked after as a fallen woman. The nuns took her baby and sold him, like thousands of others, to America for adoption. 50 years later, Philomena decided to find him. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, Philomena's son, renamed Michael Hess, is a leading lawyer in the first Bush administration. His quest to find his birth mother has been endangered by secrets that might jeopardize his career in the Republican Party. Philomena pulls back the curtain on the role of the Catholic Church in forced adoptions and on the love between a mother and son who endured a lifelong separation. John Curlis performs the book.
Sister Annunciata cursed the electric. Whenever there was thunder and lightning, it flickered so desperate it was worse than the old paraffin lamps. And tonight they needed all the light they could get. She was trying to run, but her feet were catching in her habit and her hands were shaking. Hot water slopped from the enamel bowl onto the stone flags of the darkened corridor. It was all right for the others. All they had to do was pray to the Virgin. But Sister Annunciata was expected to do something practical. The girl was dying, and no one had a clue how to save her. In the makeshift surgery above the chapel, she knelt by the patient and whispered encouragement. The girl responded with a half-smile, and something mumbled, incomprehensible. A lightning flash lit up the room. Annunciata pulled up the covers to shield the girl from the blood on the sheets. Annunciata was barely older than her patient. Both of them were from the country, both from the depths of Limerick. But she was the birth sister, and people were expecting her to do something. In the chapel below, she could hear Mother Barbara gathering the girls, ordering them to pray for the Magdalene upstairs, a sinner like them who was dying. The disembodied voices sounded distant and harsh. Annunciata squeezed the girl's hand and told her to take no notice. She lifted the patient's white linen gown and wiped her legs with the warm water. The baby was visible now, but it was the child's back she could see, not the head. She'd heard about breech births. Another hour and she knew mother and baby would both be dead. The fever was setting in. The patient was flushed, her speech reduced to quick, stumbling phrases. "Don't let them put him in the ground. It's dark down there. It's cold down there." Her blue eyes were wide with panic, her jet-black hair stark against the white pillow. Sister Annunciata bent down and wiped the girl's brow. The girl had no idea what was happening to her. She'd had no visitors since she arrived, and that was nearly 2 months ago. Her father and brother had put her in the nuns' care, and now the nuns were going to let her die. Annunciata thanked God that it wasn't herself lying there. But she was a practical girl from a farming family. She gripped the baby's flesh. It was warm and alive. Mother Barbara said sinners deserve no painkillers, and the girl was screaming, screaming for her baby. Don't let them bury him. They're burying him in the convent. With her strong fingers, and then with the hard steel forceps, Annunciata pushed and twisted the tiny body. It moved, reluctantly, loath to abandon the sensuous warmth. A gush of pale red liquid spilled onto the white sheet. Annunciata had found the baby's head. Now she was pulling it steadily forward, dragging a new life into God's world. Sister Annunciata was 23. She had been Annunciata for 5 years. Before that, she had been Mary Kelly, one of the Limerick Kellys, one of seven. The night the priest came, he had sat for a drink and commiserated with old Mr. Kelly on the ill luck that had denied him sons. After the third whiskey, he had leaned forward and said quietly, "Now, Tom, I know you love the girls, and what better could you be doing for 'em than look after their futures? Surely, Tom, you can spare one of them for God." 5 years later, here she was, Sister Annunciata, spared for God. For the next few days, whenever Annunciata was with the little one, she nursed him as if he were her own. It was she who had delivered him, saved him, launched him into the light. He had been christened Anthony, at her suggestion, and she felt they had a special bond. When he cried, she comforted him. When he was hungry, she longed to feed him.
That was Philomena by Martin Sixsmith. Mary Poppins, the quintessentially English and utterly magical children's nanny, is one of Disney's most beloved films. But as Disney struggled to bring the book to the big screen, the American press clamored to know, who is P.L. Travers? Valerie Lawson's illuminating biography, Mary Poppins, She Wrote, provides the first glimpse into the mind of a writer who fervently believed that everyday life is a miracle. Australian Pamela Lyndon Travers left Sydney for London in 1924 to work as a journalist. She traveled in the literary circles of W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot. As told in this year's Saving Mr. Banks, which starred Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks, Travers clashed famously with the great convincer Walt Disney over the adaptation of her Mary Poppins into the film. Author Lawson shows Travers remained thoroughly inscrutable and enigmatic to the end of her 96 years. Terry Donnelly narrates.
As Plath instinctively knew, Mary Poppins was not so much a plain old nanny as a good mother from a fairy tale. Hiding behind the facade of a British nanny pushing a pram in Kensington, Poppins was more magical than Cinderella's godmother, more mysterious than the good fairy of the Sleeping Beauty. But Poppins had yet another aspect. Something sinister lay behind the blue button eyes and flower pot hat. As P.L. Pamela Travers, the creator of Mary Poppins, wrote, "Every good fairy has her evil counterpart, the necessary antagonist." In Mary Poppins, Travers created more than the saccharine image we know from the Walt Disney movie of the 1960s. Poppins has lasted because she is as peculiar as she is kind, as threatening as she is comforting, as stern as she is sensual, as elusive as she is matter of fact. Where did she come from? Where did she go? The Banks children, her charges, knew only one thing. Out of the sky she came, and back to the sky she would go. Since the first book was published in 1934, Mary Poppins has become imprinted in the popular culture of many countries, almost a cartoon character, reinforced by the Walt Disney movie of 1964, its re-releases in 1973 and 1980, then the movie's release on video and DVD. The six Poppins books are still in print, and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. The words Mary Poppins have become a catchphrase, a slogan, for an idealized woman. Most recently, the nanny made a reappearance in The Simpsons, transformed into Sherry Bobbins, who tried, but failed, to make order of the chaos in that household. Even that treatment did not destroy her. Instead, it enhanced her. The image of Mary Poppins with her umbrella flying over the rooftops of London is indelible, but the concept of Mary Poppins is even stronger, implying a secure childhood and an answer to women's perennial problem, how to balance their lives between their needs and their family's demands. Mary Poppins flew into a 1930s household where the mother did not work. In the movie, Mrs. Banks became a silly suffragette, an interesting change of perspective which represented Walt Disney's response to the dawn of the new age of feminism. By the end of the 20th century, most women did work, and most mothers need childcare. If they can afford it, they hire a nanny. If not, the nanny is a worker in a childcare centre or a family daycare home. Whoever the caregiver is, the mother and father are ambivalent about the surrogate parent. The parents want to believe the best, but often they sense or imagine a bad witch's face behind the good. The mother feels anxious that the nanny will steal either her child or her husband.
That was Mary Poppins, She Wrote, The Life of P.L. Travers by Valerie Lawson. Diane Ladd has made her mark in the entertainment world as a film, TV, and stage actress, film director, producer, and author. She has appeared in over 120 roles. Diane was born in Meridian, Mississippi. She was married to actor and one-time co-star Bruce Dern from 1960 to 69, and she and her daughter from that marriage, Laura Dern, have co-starred several times. In addition to Diane's Academy Award nomination for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, she was also nominated, again in the Best Actress in a Supporting Role category, for both Wild at Heart and Rambling Rose. In both of these films, she starred alongside daughter Laura Dern, who also received a nomination for Best Actress for Rambling Rose. The dual mother-daughter nominations for Rambling Rose marked the first time in Academy Award history that such an event had occurred. They were also nominated for dual Golden Globe Awards in the same year. The pair appeared together in David Lynch's Inland Empire, and most recently they co-starred in the HBO series Enlightened from 2011 to 13. But today we'll start the conversation with Diane about her new book, A Bad Afternoon for a Piece of Cake. Welcome, Diane. It's such a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. It's my privilege and pleasure to be here with you today.
Diane, I have a philosophical question for you.
Uh-oh.
Is there really any way there could be a bad afternoon for a piece of cake?
I'm afraid there is. And I'm sharing it with you. It wasn't my bad afternoon. It was a young, handsome man, businessman, who ran into some trouble. So actually, most of my stories are based on truth. One or two of them are totally contrived from my soul or my life, my just out of the ether. But a lot of these are either a story that someone told me once or something I experienced, and they stay in my soul, and then I flushed it out into a story. But this one was based on truth.
There are 10 stories in the book, and some of them are intertwined. Isn't that right?
Yes. They're all people from Mississippi originally. That's my river running through all of their souls. And the shortest one is 8 pages, quick, and the longest one is only 22 pages. And they're saying now that short stories can help heal your energy, like a glass of wine or getting 50 miles from out of town. You refresh. You can step back and refresh. Like if you're waiting for an interview and instead of wasting your time, read a short story and you'll come back more objective, calmer, more detached, disciplined, and divinity all inside.
Uh-huh.
One of your characters, Preston Williams, from the opening story, he reappears. He sells veterinarian supplies. Was that an homage to your father, who was a veterinarian?
Absolutely. My father only went to the sixth grade in school, actually. And he was a genius, and he was one of the top veterinarians in the country. He could stand with four or five other veterinarians. He could look at a dog or a chicken and tell you what was wrong with it. He knew. He was a great man, and he loved people. He was a great inspiration in my life. I was very lucky to have had him for a father. I traveled with him when I was young throughout the South, five states sometimes. He didn't always let me go with him because we were middle class. And I would take stuff because I see people on the road with him who not only do not have a television, they don't have a radio. I saw kids who didn't have shoes to put on their feet. And one time I saw Indians cooking grass because they had nothing to eat. And I knew there was something terribly wrong in my great country. And I promised God if he would help me be a success, I would help his people. So I've tried to keep that promise. And part of that is writing. I feel like I'm a teacher, or if I'm acting, then the stage or the film is my blackboard. Or if I'm writing, it's the paper that's my blackboard. And my job in either field is to show you a part of yourself. And as I said before to you, I have an attic full of writing since I was 17. And for a long time, people just wouldn't read it. Even when I sold a screenplay to a studio, which I have, and they said, oh, don't read her script. We'll get another writer. She's just an actress.
Can you tell us a little what that will be about?
Interrupted Destiny has a political background. It is about my trying to get the film about Martha Mitchell made. And I had been invited to come to the sit in the grandstand. I've been invited by President Ford, and my seat was to be next to the great Helen Thomas. And I wanted to meet this first lady of reporters. But that morning at 4:45 exactly, I never got to meet Helen that day. I never got there to that parade. It was during that parade that someone came up and told Helen Thomas that Martha Mitchell, the wife of John Mitchell, Attorney General in the Nixon administration, had died. While that was happening, I had a paranormal experience that changed my whole life. And this book is about the paranormal experience. It has to do with Martha Mitchell. The paranormal experience continued onto the stage while I was performing that night. And Helen Thomas knows about it. Mari Povich, who had his own talk show, knows about it. I didn't meet Helen till a year and a half later, and she became one of my lifelong best friends. I bought a book in which there's a chapter there on Martha. I just had the privilege of speaking at her memorial. I was one of nine people they invited to come to Washington and speak about her. And that was a great honor for me because I loved her very much. So the book is about politics. It's about Martha. She had something to tell you. If we had listened to her, the people, the bankers, or the other people who stole our money in those awful Wall Street conanigans would never have gotten away with it. And right now, politics, medicine, and show business, the systems are broken, and they need fixing. And I hope that this book, if we listen to her now, maybe it is a day late and a dollar short, but it may help us start to mend those systems. It's just a little pebble of sand on this beach, but it's an important pebble of sand. And I write about Martha. She communicated with me from the other side of the veil and how she led my life. She got into my life. So her destiny was interrupted. My destiny was interrupted, and your destiny was interrupted. So it's called Interrupted Destiny.
I want to hear from you. What is it about the South that breeds such a distinctive crop of writers?
That's an interesting question. You know, they say that my state, Mississippi, which is certainly not on the list of the best educated by any means, has produced the greatest number of great writers, from Flannery O'Connor to my cousin Tennessee Williams to just Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty.
I want to ask you, you've co-starred with your daughter in several projects. How is she about taking direction from her mom?
She's actually great about taking direction from me, but I never directed her yet.
Right.
She directed me. she filmed a short story thing that she directed, and I was the first actor she directed. And when I said, well, Laura, I don't really do it that way. Do you think I'm trying to tell you what to do? She said she was wonderful. She's a wonderful talent, and she's a great human being. I'm very privileged that this soul chose me for a mother, because she's the light of my life. I didn't answer your complete question before. Why does it produce the greatest number of writers? I think one of the reasons is because they also said some of the greatest actors, Kim Stanley and all, have come from the South. I think that up north, you are in an apartment and you're right next to somebody and you go, hello. Sometimes you don't even talk to the people down the street or down at the end of your hall. In the South, you're spread out more. And you reach for people, like, here comes somebody down the road. They're coming down the road now. Like, thank God there's a human being. But in the North, there's lots of human beings, so you kind of pull away. In the South, you're reaching out. So I think the desire to communicate might be a stronger inspiration. And I think that could be the answer. You know, it's like only children. I was an only child, and they think, oh, well, only children are very selfish. No, it's quite the contrary. If you have sisters and brothers, you say, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine. If you're alone, you got nobody to say, it's mine. So you say, hey, Elaine, you want to come play? Here, you want this? Hey, you want that? You can have it. Come on over. You want that? You're tired of it. You've played with it all. You're bored to death. You want the person to play with you. So you want to communicate. I may be wrong, but that's the only answer I've got for you.
Well, any final thoughts about your book?
Yeah, I hope everybody buys it so I can write another one. And I wish somebody would make it a bestseller. I wish the New York critics would read my book and stop saying, oh, no, she's just an actor. Would you, somebody, for God's sakes, yell at them and give me a fair chance just because God gave me one talent? What, if I can cook steak, I shouldn't make you spaghetti, too, if I can? So somebody out there, if you love my book, please tell the New York Times. We love her book. Why aren't you reviewing her book? Somebody out there, write a letter for me, please. You do, and I'll say a prayer for you, okay?
I loved your book.
Oh, Elaine loved my book. A Bad Afternoon for a Piece of Cake.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks so much, Diane. American Hustle just may sweep the Oscars. It's nominated for most of the big awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor and Actress, Best Supporting Actor and Actress. If you saw the film, I bet you'd agree, it is most definitely Oscar-worthy. The Stingman Inside App Scam by Robert Greene is the amazing inside story of Mel Weinberg, an incredibly fascinating fast buck operator. The book chronicles the scandals he masterminded, hustling his way from the streets of the Bronx to hawking bogus businesses around the world. Weinberg netted millions and famously dreamed up Abscam, the infamous FBI-run sting operation of the late 1970s that would bag 7 congressmen and 1 U.S. senator. Eduardo Ballerini narrates.
The United States Courthouse for the Eastern District of New York is a white concrete rectangle in what is known as downtown Brooklyn. It's a clean, efficient, but graceless building, with a shabbily kept park fringed with maple trees opposite the main entrance. A cool haven from the hot summer sun, and a nighttime refuge for muggers and perverts. A few blocks away, over the gargoyled facades of turn-of-the-century office buildings, the pillars of the Brooklyn Bridge spear the sky, dimly visible through a blue haze of exhaust fumes. Motorists fight for parking spaces on the narrow street fronting the courthouse, amid a confusion of signs warning that the block has been reserved for the parking convenience of government bureaucrats. It was the shank of August 1980. At 9 a.m. on this day, it was characteristically hot and humid in Brooklyn, and federal workers raced the last few steps to reach the air-conditioned coolness of the lobby. Despite the humidity, the air was electric with anticipation. Television newsmen with their camera crews were assembling on the sidewalks, and press photographers congregated against the row of parked cars at the curb. It was during this preparatory moment of relative calm that a nondescript car with government plates eased down the street and abruptly nosed into a reserved parking spot. The driver, a modishly slim FBI agent, quickly exited and walked around to the passenger side, glancing up and down the street as he moved. The agent nodded quickly, and the passenger door sprang open. Out stepped Melvin, no middle initial, Weinberg. Blinking owlishly in the sun despite his tinted aviator-style sunglasses, Mel Weinberg snipped the end from a huge Te Amo Toro cigar, jammed it into the corner of his mouth, and scanned the sidewalk running to the courthouse door. "Photographers," he said to his companion, FBI agent Tony Amoroso. Weinberg spoke softly. The only visual indication that he was talking was a slight up-and-down jiggle of the Churchillian cigar. "Walk like we belong and they'll think we're part of the scenery," said Amoroso. Weinberg grinned agreement, and the two men moved down the street, past the idle photographers and into the courthouse. They took the elevator up to the third-floor offices of the Eastern District Federal Strike Force. When the two men strolled into the large, nearly empty ready room, several agents murmured automatic greetings before returning to their gin-rummy game. Weinberg and Amoroso slumped into easy chairs and sat quietly. They'd worked together for nearly 2 years, and felt no need to fill comfortable silence with useless words. Each was deep in his own thoughts. Mel Weinberg took stock of himself. For a 55-year-old confidence man, swindler, avid hustler of the fast buck, the avenues of life seemed to be merging this morning at the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse. He couldn't complain. For a runny-nosed kid who'd barely graduated from grammar school, he hadn't done badly. Learning, always learning, he had progressed through a 35-year career in white-collar crime. From hustling phony gold contracts over Formica top tables at all-night diners to lavish office suites on Long Island, a staff of 500 franchise salesmen, and an annual cash income of more than $500,000. He had worked North America and five other continents, fleecing public officials, movie stars, dictators, generals, mobsters, political terrorists, and ordinary businessmen with democratic impartiality. His enemies regarded him as a conniving crook. Neutrals called him a rogue, and a small army of underworld admirers and incredulous cops added to the legend daily as they swapped Weinberg stories in the world's bars, jails, cafes, courtrooms, and whorehouses. The money was good, and through the years Weinberg had developed an appetite for first-class living. But as he readily admits to himself and his few close friends, the real reward of scamming is the fun of the game. Each new mark or potential victim was a new mind to be wrestled to the ground in a one-on-one battle of wits. For a bright, agile-minded person like Weinberg, who compensates for his lack of education by sneering at books and passionately embracing the argot of the New York streets, there was heady satisfaction in skinning the powerful, well-educated elite of the business and government world.
We've just heard The Sting Man, Inside Abscam, by Robert Greene. Captain Phillips received Oscar nods for Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Adapted Screenplay. The movie is, of course, based on A Captain's Duty, Somali Pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea, by Richard Phillips with Stephen Talty. It was just another day on the job for 53-year-old Richard Phillips, captain of the Maersk, Alabama, a U.S. cargo ship carrying, among other things, food and agricultural materials for the World Food Program. Then, armed Somali pirates boarded the ship. The pirates didn't expect the crew to fight back, nor did they expect Captain Phillips to offer himself as a hostage in exchange for the safety of his crew. Thus began the tense 5-day standoff, which ended in a daring high seas rescue when U.S. Navy SEALs opened fire and picked off 3 of the captors. A story of adventure and courage, A Captain's Duty provides the intimate details of the high seas hostage taking, the unbearable heat, the death threats, the mock executions, and the escape attempt. When the pirates boarded his ship, Captain Phillips puts his experience into action, doing everything he could to safeguard his crew. It was the moment where training meets instinct and where character is everything. George K. Wilson narrates.
He was pulling the trigger of his 9mm, dry firing it. In the darkness, I couldn't see if the gun was pointed at me, but I felt a cold sensation creep across my chest. The little didn't have a clip in the gun, or my head would have exploded in a big red spray against the hull. No bullets in the chamber, either. Yet. And then, out of the darkness, I heard the chanting. From the cockpit, the leader called out something in this droning voice, and the other three, tall guy, Musa, and the crazy-eyed young guy, answered him. I leaned forward, trying to figure out what they were saying. It was obviously some kind of religious ceremony, like a Latin Catholic mass back in Massachusetts when I was growing up. A few hours ago, these guys had been laughing and telling jokes and boasting how they were real Somali sailors 24/7. You could almost forget they were pirates, and I was their hostage. Now everything was different. It was like we'd gone back 10 centuries, and they were asking Allah for his blessing for what they were about to do. I knew what was happening, but I didn't have to sit there and take it. "What are you going to do now? Kill me?" I yelled up to the leader. In the darkness, I could hear him laugh. I saw the flash of his teeth, and then he coughed and spit. Then the four of them went back to the chanting. I tried to move my hands and loosen the rope, but I had to give it to Musa. He could tie a knot like nobody's business. The prayers came to an end just like that. The boat was quiet, and I could hear the splashing of the waves again. I stared into the darkness, looking to see the muzzle of an AK-47 being raised toward me. Nothing.
"You have a family?"
The voice was mocking, self-assured. He was the leader, no question. "Yeah, I have a family," I said. I realized with a feeling of panic that I hadn't said my goodbyes to them. I bit down on my lip.
"Daughter? Son?"
"I have a son, a daughter, and a wife." Silence. I heard some rustling up near the cockpit. Then the leader spoke again.
"That's too bad," he said.
He was trying to rattle me, and he was doing a damn good job of it, actually.
"Yeah, that is too bad," I shot back.
Whatever they did or said, I couldn't let them know they'd gotten to me. Musa came toward me down the aisle of the lifeboat. He took some white cotton cloth that he'd torn from a shirt and laced it through the ropes around my hands. He didn't pull them tight, just twined them around the ropes. Then he took out some parachute-type lines, one red, one white, and started lacing those through. Slowly. His face was maybe a foot from mine, and I could see him concentrating hard on what he was doing. The white and red lines were looped around in this intricate pattern that he had to get exactly right. It's a weird feeling, watching yourself being prepared to die. It was like they expected me to go along with my own murder, to be a good victim and not say a word. I felt a jolt of anger shoot through me. These guys were not going to take me away from my family, from everything and everyone I loved. No way. When Musa was done, he walked back to the cockpit. The Somali started talking again, regular conversation this time, and they seemed to come to some kind of an agreement. I saw the leader hand his pistol to tall guy, who came walking down the aisle toward me. So, he'd been chosen to do the job. Tall guy sat down behind me on the orange survival suit. For some reason, they had to be standing or sitting on something orange or red during the ritual. He checked the 9mm clip, slammed it back in, and then played with the gun. It was like he was toying with me. The one I called young guy, the one who'd been staring at me the whole 2 days, smiling like a deranged maniac.
We've just heard A Captain's Duty by Richard Phillips.
When the Fox Film Corporation merged with 20th Century Pictures in 1935, the company posed little threat to industry giants Paramount and MGM. In the years that followed, guided by executives Daryl F. Zanuck and Spiros Skouras, it emerged as one of the most important studios. Though working from separate offices in New York and L.A., and often of two different minds, the two men navigated 20th Century Fox through the trials of the World War II boom, the birth of TV, and the Hollywood blacklist to an era of exceptional success, which included what was then the highest-grossing movie of all time, The Sound of Music. 20th Century Fox, the Zanuck-Skouras years, 1935 to 1965 by Peter Lev, is a comprehensive examination of the studio's transformation. Lev delves into corporate strategies, distribution models, government relations, and technological innovations. Drawn largely from original archival research, the book presents a unique perspective on the evolution of the modern film industry. Garrett Martin narrates.
My preparation for this project began about the year 2002, when I was writing a book on Hollywood in the 1950s. I noticed that among the studios, 20th Century Fox had the best story to tell. Huge triumphs and failures, excellent films, extraordinary characters. With a little research, I found that 20th Century Fox's first 30 years covered a great sweep of film history, from the Shirley Temple years to the World War II boom, the challenge of television, the Hollywood blacklist, and the expensive and scandalous production of Cleopatra. Dozens of interesting characters were involved. The actors Tyrone Power, Betty Grable, Gregory Peck, and Marilyn Monroe. The directors John Ford, Henry King, Elia Kazan, Otto Preminger, and Joseph L. Mankiewicz. The writers John Steinbeck, Nunnally Johnson, Lamar Trotti, Philip Dunn, and Ring Lardner Jr. The producers Jerry Wald and Walter Wenger, and so on. The story goes from the specific to the general, following the thoroughly connected histories of 20th Century Fox, the Hollywood film industry, and the United States of America. But most of all, the story is about two powerful executives, Daryl F. Zanuck and Spiros Skouras, who represent two distinct aspects of the film industry. 20th Century Fox was created by the merger of Fox Film Corporation and 20th Century Pictures in 1935. Fox Film was a pioneer film company, tracing its roots to William Fox's purchase of a Brooklyn Nickelodeon in 1904. Sidney Kent, president of Fox Film, merged his company with the much smaller 20th Century Pictures in 1935 because 20th Century had shown a consistent ability to make high-quality films while controlling cost. The major assets of 20th Century were its executives, film industry veteran Joseph Schenck, and young but gifted head of production, Daryl F. Zanuck. The new 20th Century Fox was no threat to MGM or Paramount in its first few years, but Kent, Zanuck, and Schenck quickly built it into one of the most important Hollywood studios. In 1942, Sidney Kent died. Spiros Skouras, his replacement as president, would, with Zanuck, guide the company for the next few decades.
That was 20th Century Fox by Peter Lev. Fireball, Carol Lombard, and the Mystery of Flight 3 is a fresh look at Hollywood's Queen of Screwball, Carol Lombard. Robert Mattson presents a first-ever examination of the events that led to the shocking flight mishap that took the actress's life on the side of a Nevada mountain in 1942. It also provides a day-by-day account of the struggles of Lombard's husband, Clark Gable, and other family and friends and fans to cope with the tragedy. The War Department offered Gable a funeral service with full military honors, but he refused it, knowing his wife would not approve of such a spectacle. Based on extensive research, this investigation explores the lives of the 21 others on the plane, including 15 members of the U.S. Army Air Corps, and addresses one of the most enduring mysteries of World War II.
on a clear night, with TWA's most experienced pilot at the controls of a new aircraft, why did the flight crash into a mountainside? Tavia Gilbert narrates.
Aboard TWA Flight 3, on takeoff from McCarran Field, the soft-hearted, hard-charging, caffeine-fueled, self-promoting, profanity-laced, nicotine-addicted, business-oriented, and usually optimistic sexpot and perpetual motion machine known to the world as Carol Lombard could finally see the end of the road. A Hoosier from Fort Wayne, Indiana, she was born Jane Alice Peters, the third child of Frederick and Elizabeth Knight Peters. Fred had money, and Bess came from money. Money would practically grow on every tree in the vicinity of Carol Lombard her whole life. But having money didn't mean that the kid had it easy. "I always had the feeling that I couldn't keep up," she said of a youth spent in the shadow of two older brothers, which is odd, considering that Carol Lombard gave the appearance all her Hollywood life of being comfortable in her own skin. Whether posing in a negligee or bathing suit, and nobody in the 1930s struck more cheesecake poses than Lombard, dancing on screen, shooting skeet, attending the Academy Awards dinner, camping in long johns, or launching Gone with the Wind with 150,000 people looking on, Lombard always seemed on the verge of saying, "You bet your ass I belong here." But did she belong in her own family? Before Fred and Bess had married, he had nearly been killed in an industrial accident at the manufacturing plant owned by his father. Fred had been mashed up pretty bad and nearly lost a leg. But it was the head injury that would plague him the rest of his life, perhaps a lesion on his brain, perhaps a clot or tumor. And after his marriage to Bess and the birth of their three children, headaches crippled him. And then came seizures so frightening that Bess feared she would have to take the children away. The episodes didn't seem to be spells of epilepsy, the falling sickness, but more on the order of blind rages, for which there was then no cure, no warning, and absolutely no defense. It was the dark cloud in an otherwise bucolic turn-of-the-century life in Fort Wayne. Jane grew up idolizing her two big brothers, Freddie, nicknamed Fritz, and Stuart, known as Tootie, after Jane's early attempts at Stuart. Endless tagging along with Fritz and Tootie hardened Jane into a tomboy, the likes of Scout in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Before her sixth birthday, Jane was packed up with brothers and mother for a vacation west to California, the farthest point in the United States from Fred and his problem. As funded by Bess's well-heeled family, and later by Fred Peters himself, the group of four found an apartment in Los Angeles, and the vacation turned into a lifestyle. Jane was a quiet child, fair-haired, blue-eyed, with no hint of the raucous and profane personality of her adult life. She was a thoughtful girl and a follower, easy to laugh, quick with a joke, and possessing a love of the silent pictures that drew her in and spawned ambition. Mother Bess moved the family to a big house on South Harvard in the affluent Wilshire Boulevard district of Los Angeles, just around the corner from the Ambassador Hotel. Future director Delmer Daves was a childhood friend of Fred and Stuart Peters. "We were front door friends," said Daves. "We sat on the steps and talked about whatever boys talked about. And Carol was the kid's sister, and really beneath our attention. She teased me about it later." Dave's expression grew sour, and he added, "Carol at that time was not an attractive girl. She was scrawny." In this neighborhood that Dave's described as rather elegant, the entire Peters family fell in with the Hollywood crowd. For Jane Peters, it was a magical place to grow up. "I can remember myself as a little girl," said Carol Lombard later, "standing at the corner of Hollywood and Vine watching my idol, Gloria Swanson." Jane decided then, "I too was going to have a screen career, and I've never deviated from my purpose."
We have just heard Fireball by Robert Matson.
On Oscar night, The Wolf of Wall Street will be quite the contender. It's up for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor and Supporting Actor, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Whether or not you love the movie, I bet you'll agree that DiCaprio truly deserved his Best Actor nomination. By day, Jordan Belfort made thousands of dollars a minute. By night, he blew it as fast as he could. From the binge that sank a 170-foot motor yacht, crashed a Gulfstream jet, and ran up a $700,000 hotel tab, to the fast-talking, hard-partying young stockbrokers who called him king. Here, in Jordan Belfort's own words, is the story of the ill-fated genius. In the 90s, Belfort became one of the most infamous kingpins in American finance, a brilliant, conniving stock chopper who led his merry mob on a wild ride. It's an extraordinary story of greed, power, and excess no one could invent. Eric Myers narrates.
He kept walking and talking as I followed one step behind, mesmerized by the thousands of orange diode stock quotes that came skidding across gray-colored computer monitors. At the front of the room, a wall of plate glass looked out over Midtown Manhattan. Up ahead, I could see the Empire State Building. It towered above everything, seeming to rise up to the heavens and scrape the sky. It was a sight to behold, a sight worthy of a young master of the universe, and right now, that goal seemed further and further away.
"To tell you the truth," sputtered Scott, "I don't think you're cut out for this job. You look like a kid, and Wall Street's no place for kids. It's a place for killers, a place for mercenaries. So in that sense, you're lucky I'm not the one who does the hiring around here."
He let out a few ironic chuckles. I bit my lip and said nothing. The year was 1987, and yuppie like Scott seemed to rule the world. Wall Street was in the midst of a raging bull market, and freshly minted millionaires were being spit out a dime a dozen. Money was cheap, and a guy named Michael Milken had invented something called junk bonds, which had changed the way corporate America went about its business. It was a time of unbridled greed, a time of wanton excess. It was the era of the yuppie. As we neared his desk, my yuppie nemesis turned to me and said,
"I'll say it again, Jordan. You're the lowest of the low. You're not even a cold caller yet. You're a connector."
Disdain dripped off the very word.
"And, till you pass your Series 7, connecting will be your entire universe. And that is why you are lower than pond scum. You got a problem with that?"
"Absolutely not," I replied. "It's the perfect job for me because I am lower than pond scum." I shrugged innocently. Unlike Scott, I don't look like a goldfish, which made me feel proud as he stared at me, searching my face for irony. I'm on the short side, though, and at the age of 24, I still had the soft, boyish features of an adolescent. It was the sort of face that made it difficult for me to get into a bar without getting proofed. I had a full head of light brown hair, smooth olive skin, and a pair of big blue eyes. Not altogether bad-looking. But alas, I hadn't been lying to Scott when I'd told him that I felt lower than pond scum. In point of fact, I did. The problem was that I had just run my first business venture into the ground, and my self-esteem had been run into the ground with it. It had been an ill-conceived venture into the meat and seafood industry, and by the time it was over, I had found myself on the end of 26 truck leases, all of which I'd personally guaranteed, and all of which were now in default. So the banks were after me, as was some belligerent woman from American Express, a bearded 300-pounder by the sound of her, who was threatening to personally kick my ass if I didn't pay up. I had considered changing my phone number, but I was so far behind on my phone bill that 9X was after me too. We reached Scott's desk, and he offered me the seat next to his, along with some kind words of encouragement.
"Look at the bright side," he quipped. "If by some miracle you don't get fired for laziness, stupidness, insolence, or tardiness, then you might actually become a stockbroker one day."
He smirked at his own humor.
"And just so you know, last year I made over $300,000, and the other guy you'll be working for made over $1 million.
Over $1 million? I could only imagine what an the other guy was. With a sinking heart, I asked, who's the other guy?
Why? Asked my yuppie tormentor. What's it to you?
Sweet, I thought. Only speak when spoken to, you nincompoop. It was like being in the Marines. In fact, I was getting the distinct impression that this bastard's favorite movie was An Officer and a Gentleman, and he was playing out a Lou Gossett fantasy on me, pretending he was a drill sergeant in charge of a substandard Marine. But I kept that thought to myself, and all I said was, nothing. I was just, curious.
That was The Wolf of Wall Street by Jordan Belfort. Readers, in my opinion, the Oscar goes to the talented authors who wrote the diverse and fascinating group of titles. To review, the nominees for Best Adapted Screenplay are Before Midnight, Captain Phillips, Philomena, 12 Years a Slave, and The Wolf of Wall Street. If your reading preferences go a bit farther afield, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for the latest titles. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope all your favorite films win. But see you back here in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.